morning. Today, we continue the discussion of the construction of the SU2 non-Abelian gauge series, and I'm going to do two things. First, I'm going to discuss a bit more the status of currents in the theory, because I had many questions last time. And the main part, I start to discuss the quantization and gauge fixing procedure, which is very important. So first, before dealing with current, just let me remind you the notation we had. So we consider a gauge theory, a theory of vector particles, based on the group SU2. So we have a gauge field, which is a gauge potential. It's the analog of the vector potential, which we denote A mu, okay, which is in fact a collection of A mu A of X, where A are associated to the three generator, and this is associated to the three generator of SU2. So A mu lives, in fact, in the Lie algebra, which is an adjoint representation of SU2. And so if we take as a generator one half the Pauli matrices, the 2x2 Pauli matrices, we can rewrite A mu, and that's what I'm going to use, A mu as A mu A T A, which means that it is a 2x2 Hermitian matrix with, if I'm not mistaken, I have A 3 mu A 1 mu minus I A 2 mu A 1 mu or plus, minus and plus, I don't remember, it's very important, A mu 2 minus A mu 3. So it's a 2x2 Hermitian matrix. Okay? And the effect of gauge transformation if G is an element of SU2, namely it's a 2x2 unitary matrix, is that A mu goes into G times A mu plus I derivative with respect to x in the direction mu of g minus 1. And this is a 2x2 matrix, 2x2 matrix, 2x2 matrix. So this is a 2x2 matrix. So this is, if you want, what we are going to call A mu transformed by g. Okay? And the infinitesimal version of that, if g mu is the matrix 1 plus I times alpha plus something where alpha is a 2x2 Hermitian matrix because it's a generator of the algebra, is A mu goes to A mu plus D mu A mu, where D mu is the covariant derivative. I'm sorry, D mu of alpha, of course. And d mu of alpha is defined as the ordinary derivative of alpha minus I, a commutator of A mu and alpha. Okay? This is the covariant derivative. Well, defined when acting in the fundamental representation, so acting on 2 by 2 matrices. Representation. Okay. So out of this, we'll construct the field strength. F mu nu, which again is an element in the Lie algebra. So it's a 2 by 2 Hermitian matrix, but with coefficient, which is defined as I times covariant derivatives. So it involves a covariant derivative. So it is in terms of components. It's d mu a nu minus d nu a mu minus I, the commutator of a mu and a nu. Okay, so this is the field strength. And here again, and which is the analog of the electromagnetic tensor. So it contains electric and magnetic field. But now you have three different kinds of electric and magnetic field. And the field strength transforms covariantly. So it's a covariant object. Which means that under gauge transformation, F mu nu transforms as G times F mu nu times G minus 1. Okay. And out of this, we can construct Young-Mills action of the field, which is S of A mu, which is minus 1 over 2 G squared, integral over space-time of trace of F mu nu, F nu mu, something like that. Okay, which is gauge invariant. Which is the analog of the Maxwell action, the action for the Maxwell electromagnetic field for a field associated to a non-abelian gauge group. So vector potential carrying interaction between non-abelian currents. Okay. Okay, so currents. Chup, where was it? So I told you that the gauge particles, if you want, that comes out from this field, carry charges. That's different from the one Maxwell theory. And that's because of this term. And I wrote an expression for the current. So there is a current. In fact, there are three currents that can be, as usual, grouped in a multiplet. And this current is given, it's proportional to, let me not be very precise, it's proportional to epsilon, well, let me the current here. Epsilon ABC F mu nu B A mu C. So this is in terms of components. But you can rewrite it by writing the current like a current G mu equal G mu ATA. So this is now a current which is a matrix. So it contains three currents. You can write that G mu is proportional, let's say, to the commutator of of f mu nu, because this is just a structure constant of the algebra. So it's a commutator of f mu nu with a nu. Okay? And the question we discussed whether this current was a gauge invariant, gauge covariant. So, and I was not very precise for good reason that I don't understood everything. So here I worked out what's going on. So if you want to discuss a little bit to understand the structure of the current, you should understand that something that I have not discussed, which what are the equation of motion classical equation for the field strengths. So what are the analog of Maxwell equation for this non-abelian field strengths? And in fact, there are two equations. There are two pairs of equations. One equation, which is just the equation that the covariant derivative d mu of f mu nu is equal to zero in the absence of matter field. Otherwise, you have the contribution. So I'm not to discuss, so no matter field at that stage. Okay. So this is the equation you obtain by taking the variation of the action and stating that the classical equation of motion are equation gauge field corresponding to a stationary point of the action. Okay. So these are, if you want, the equation of motion. That comes equation of motion of the theory. And you have another equation, which is d mu of the dual of f mu nu, which is equal to zero, which is called the Bianchi identity for gauge field, where f tilde mu nu is just epsilon mu nu rho sigma f rho sigma d equal 4. So it's a dual of the tensor. Okay? So this is a consistency equation. This is a usual consistency equation that comes from the fact that f mu nu is obtained from a vector potential, a mu. Okay. And if you write this equation for the zero component, you get an equation for the electric field. And for the space component, you get the equation for the magnetic field. And you get, so you get four equations for each component, for each field. Remember, you have three electric field and three magnetic field. So you get equation for EA and BA. A equal 1, 3. Okay, so you have those three equations. And these equations, since f mu nu contains term nonlinear in the vector potential, and since the d mu, you have to take this one, that contains another a mu, you see that these equations, in general, contains terms that are trilinear, if I'm not mistaken, trilinear in the field. So they are nonlinear equations. These consistency equations are nonlinear equations. Partial differential equation. So already the classical physics of gauge field is a very interesting subject that has been studied since a long time by physicists and mathematicians. It's very rich. The classical solutions are not just plane waves. Okay, so now, this is an expression you can obtain using Noether theorem. But since d mu of f mu nu is equal to zero, and that the covariant derivative is the ordinary derivative minus the commutator, you can see that the current g mu can be rewritten, something is also proportional to d mu, d nu of f mu nu with some I coefficient using the equation of motion. And from this point of view, it's very easy that d mu g mu is equal to 0. So it's conserved current. Simply because f mu nu is antisymmetric. Because f mu nu is equal to minus f nu mu. Because it comes from a commutator. Okay, so it's a conserved current. Okay? But now, if you are asking, is it a gauge invariant? The answer is no. G mu is not gauge covariant. So you may ask, is there a problem of consistency? If you use a different gauge, if you make a gauge transformation, G mu is not gauge invariant. And the answer, so is it a problem? It's not really a problem because when you define what is a conserved current using Noether theorem, in fact, there is a freedom. There are ambiguities in defining the currents. Okay. The important point is that the currents are conserved, but it's not a real problem, because it means simply that basically if you change of gauge representation, you change the definition of the current itself. Okay? Because you have some freedom in defining the current G mu. Okay, and for instance, you can check that, in fact, the important thing is to define what are the charge, the global charge. And if in a region of space, you want to define what is the charge, the total charge, Q, right, now you have three different kinds of charge. And if you want to define what is the concept of the value of the charge inside a region of space, if you perform a gauge transformation, g of x, which is equal to a constant g outside of the region, let's say D, domain of space. Okay? And which is constant, so it's constant. And it's non-constant inside D, you can check that if you make such a big transformation, the charge Q transforms. Remember, you have three charges, so you can put them in a multiplet in the adjoint representation, transforms as GQ. G minus 1, where G is what's happening outside. So whatever happens inside, it doesn't affect the definition of the total charge. The total charge rotates because you have an unabelian symmetry, but that's consistent. So everything is consistent. Okay? So charge is defined in a global way. Yes?
Our current J is the algebra valued as well, right?
Yes.
So how is that the derivative that we have there, that divergence is well defined? I mean, shouldn't we use a covariant derivative for this?
No, I just take the total. Well, this is the ordinary derivative.
But why do we do this?
I mean, it has this property.
But it's not well defined, right? Because J mu is the algebra valued.
Pardon? No. You can define what is the ordinary derivative of a matrix.
But then this is not a gauge-independent statement.
No, it's not. In.
But you could have some gauge-independent if you...
No, but the point is that if you make a gauge transformation, G mu gets transformed into another G mu, which is also conserved. If you use the equation of motion, you need to use the equation of motion, as usual. When you consider conservation law and currents, you use the equation of motion. Yes?
If I'm allowed to make an analogy to general relativity.
Pardon?
If I'm allowed to make an analogy to general relativity.
Yes, you are allowed, especially since I'm not a specialist of general relativity.
So then,
so please.
J mu would be the stress energy tensor, for example, for the conserved charge in a way, which would be T mu. But then we say that this is zero under the covariant derivative rather than the ordinary derivative. So that's why Jens's statement seems to make sense.
Okay. Yeah, you are probably right. Okay, thank you.
It's actually cool to do.
Yes.
So if the current is not gauge invariant, is it not observable?
It is not
observable. I mean, if I try to measure the current experimentally, like then it seems a little bit ambiguous. Which
I think you always measure charges and movement of charges. So I think if a particle is observable, then you can measure a current.
Gauge transformation to change the
value. Okay, I think a correct answer to your question is that this is classical theory. If you want to deal with quantum theory, and you have particles, etc., you need to quantize the theory and use a gauge fixing procedure and see whether everything is consistent. And we are going to see that today or tomorrow that if you want to perform gauge fixing in a consistent way in an abelian gauge series, you have an additional contribution that comes from intermediate states that is associated to some kind of strange field called the ghost field, the Fadiyev Popov ghost. And those fields carry also charges. Okay. And therefore, this means that there must be, this is an expression for the classical theory where no gauge fixing is done. If you want to define this object in the gauge theory, in the quantized theory, you need to gauge fix the theory to define what you are computing. Then there will be an additional contribution that comes from the ghost. And when you work out everything, I think the total current will be conserved. And it will be, if you fix the gauge, you have no gauge invariance. It doesn't make sense to consider gauge invariance anymore. But gauge invariance in a gauge fixed theory is replaced by a symmetry called the BRST symmetry. So it should be a BRST invariant. And at the end of the game, when you observe current, to define current in the quantized theory in a proper way, since those ghost field, as the name indicates, are never really observable, so you cannot create a ghost in an experiment. What comes in and comes out are real current, and they must be conserved. Okay, so that's all what I think I'm able to say, which is sensible. So there is no inconsistency in the theory. You know, when you make experiment and you send charged particles at LHC, the charge that comes out is equal to the charge that's come in. So the charge is conserved. Yes?
So here we have a few tensors. So can we use that to define something like a Lorentz force? A Lorentz force, like classical force that acts on a particle?
Yes. Yes, I think so, yes.
But
yes.
Here the few tensor is like not like gauge invariant, so in that case,
the force will
also not
be gauge invariant. No, I don't think so, because I think here you have exactly the same question that in ordinary QED.
But in ordinary QED, the Q tensor is the gauge invariant.
Is it?
It's gauge invariant.
Yeah, here it's gauge covariant, because you have. It means that if you rotate the definition of your charge, if you rotate in the internal SU2 space, you have to change the definition of you change the definition of the local stress energy tensor, but you change also the definition of the charge that are carried by your particles that interacts with the field. And at the end, because it rotates too, you know. The rotation, which is just a pure phase for the wave function of an electron in QED, so it's not observable, becomes a rotation in this in the space of charges of the carried by the quark, and the total force will be invariant because you change the electromagnetic tensor or the Young-Mills field strength tensor, but you change also the charge carried by you the particles. You have to, okay. Yes?
Why do we define the G outside and inside domain?
Well, it was just an argument to show that this is consistent, so that if you define the charge inside a domain or the total charge up to infinity, and you make a local gauge transformation inside, but simply a rigid transformation outside, which is the original rigid symmetry we started from, then the charge is well defined. It transforms in a consistent way. It's just an argument to show that this is consistent. Okay? Okay, let me stop this discussion, but I didn't want it to make it too long, but just to state that everything is consistent, in fact. But one has to be a bit more careful than in QED. Okay, so now let's go back to the problem, the issue of how do we quantize a theory? So quantization, the question is, can we quantize by a path integral, or rather a functional integral method? And as we have seen before, there is a problem which is in fact exactly the same than for QED or for Maxwell's theory, which is a problem that if you want to define Feynman rules for this theory, we have seen that this theory has a propagator and have interaction vertices, because this is the theory is non-abelian. So the propagator of the gauge field is obtained just by linearizing the Young-Mills action. And linearizing the Young-Mills action means keeping only the term that is linear in F mu nu. Okay, so at the linear order, the Young-Mills action is just quadratic in the field, and it's minus, we have seen, 1 over 4 g squared integral d4x. And then you have to take the trace of the dA mu a nu minus d nu a mu. So this is the usual d mu a nu minus d nu a mu a. Remember that the field carry indices. Basically squared. So let's see. D nu A mu minus D mu A nu A. Summing over all the repeated indices. And of course, it should be rather an H mu nu. Right, so it's a bit complicated. So let me just d mu a nu minus d mu a summing of repeated indices, and I am in the standard metric in Minkowski space. So I'm in Minkowski 1-3 space. Okay, so that exactly the same linear action that for Maxwell field, except that you have so it's like Maxwell. Except that we have three photons, phi you want, instead of 1, labeled by A. Yes?
Is this expression the same if they're not talking about SON?
Is that the same?
It is for SO2, right?
Yes.
Would it change much if you took another group?
If I make?
If you choose other non-abelian group.
Pardon?
If you choose other group.
No, it would be the same. Basically, you will have the same thing with A. For instance, for SU3, A goes from 1 to 8. Okay. There might be a slight modification if the group is not semi-simple, and then you have different traces, and you may have a different coefficient here, but up to some normalization, it will be the same. Yes?
So it's just the sum of three Maxwell actions?
Yes.
So okay.
Yes. Okay. But that's just for the linear term of the action that we have seen after that. The full group theory structure comes out. Okay. And so basically the linear term, the linear term for the action, you can write it as in a very sketchy way, a dkx, some A mu A nu B times some kernel. K A B mu nu. Which contains basically products of operators. It contains two derivatives, so it's a second order linear differential operator. And if you want to define what is a propagator, this propagator that in fact carries indices between A mu and B nu, which corresponds basically to the vacuum expectation value of two field A mu, A nu B in the vacuum of the theory for the linearized theory should be the inverse of this operator. Okay? As we did for the bosonic and the Dirac field. But, so this is a propagator, but the point is that because of gauge invariance, K has zero modes. Because of gauge invariance. Because if you change A by performing a gauge transformation and at linear order, a gauge transformation means simply changing A mu A into A mu A plus D mu some function alpha A of X at linear order. It's just as for U1. The action doesn't change. So it means that if you change A by a total derivative, the quadratic form doesn't change. So it has zero modes. And if you work out in momentum space what this means, it means that in momentum space, where basically K mu nu AB is delta AB, something like K mu, K nu, minus k squared h mu nu. As for U1, it means that if you k mu times k mu nu ab is always equal to zero. So this is a zero mode. The zero modes are just total derivative or fields that are linear in k mu. Okay, so this is zero mode. So you cannot invert k. Yes?
Delta AB in the that the photons don't talk to each other, right? Balance is a linear theory, so the photons don't talk to each other. The linearized green.
Yeah, so in QED, it's not a very serious problem because indeed the photons do not talk to each other. So gauge fixing and computing works. So it's already non-trivial. I think you have seen that, and you are going to see that if you follow the course of next week. There is a course on QED, some advanced QED course. So for U1 theory, you just gauge fix, then compute. And gauge fixing amounts, in general, just to change the propagator, to project out the propagator, to project out those zero modes. Okay. So it just... But we are going to see that for the SU2, you have to do the same thing, but the result is more complicated and more interesting. You have to do gauge fixing. Then construct the correct path integral, which turns out to be more complicated, and then compute. And if you do this in a consistent way, you should be okay. So let me just discuss a little bit what is gauge fixing. So gauge fixing is just choosing a representative of in the field of gauge potential that correspond to a physical configuration, so a field strength. Okay, which means basically, choose a class of representatives of the AMU. And there are many examples of well-known, and that's what we are going to use already. You can use, the what's called the axial gauge. You can use the Landau gauge. You can use the Lorentz gauge. So you can use the Coulomb gauge, gradient of AMU. I'm sorry. Oh, okay, so let us write AMU as a potential and the gauge and the vector potential. This is A0, if you want, A0 and A. So you can use the Coulomb gauge, which is gradient of A equals 0. You can use the axial gauge, which is A0 equals 0. You can use the Coulomb gauge. You can use the Lorentz gauge, which is d mu a mu equals 0, which is called the Lorentz gauge. And this gauge has the advantage of being relativistic or Lorentz invariant, while this one is one. And simply, for our problem, you just have to take into account that you have three different kinds of gauge potentials. You can do something like A. Okay, and you can take mixture, etc., and you may invent more complicated gauge. Okay. So, is it possible to do the same thing for non-Abelian gauge theory, and what's going on? So, let me first state that. Oh, and you have another gauge, which is just. Okay, well, often it is called also the Landau gauge because it has been used in QED by Landau. Okay. And there is another generalization of that that I'm going to discuss a bit later. Okay. So the principle of a path integral is that we want to define a functional integral of the form big integral over all the field configuration that I'm going to call dA exponential of I S Young-Mills of A. That's my okay, and I'm going to write to use very, very compact notation to make things simpler, so not to write all the group and Lorentz indices. So let me try to write things. Okay, so A is in fact the data of all A mu A of X for X belonging to Minkowski space. Mu goes from 1 to D, or to 4, or 0 to 3, if you prefer. And, of course, A goes from 1 to 3, because we are SU2. SU2, that's because we are in 4-dimensional space-time, etc. Okay. So basically, A designs is a gauge field gauge potential configuration. Okay, I'm not specifying what are the regularity conditions, which are important, but for, okay. And therefore, we have defined what is S Young-Mills, and the measure will be taken to be, it's very formal, it's just a product of X, products of mu, products of A, of the naive measure over d mu A of X. Okay, that's very formal, but it's okay. So I am integrating over all the possible gauge field configurations. If you are worried about what this means, there is a consistent definition of gauge fields on a lattice space-time, so we discretize space-time, that has been invented by Ken Wilson, again, Ken Wilson, in 74, I think, around 74. Which makes this perfectly well defined, which is a discretization that is perfectly well defined and very useful. So, but I'm not going to discuss it. Okay. And so, so this is the notation for gauge potential. And since I'm going to discuss the effect of gauge transformation, I'm going to denote and let me denote, so I'm continuing here, let me denote A, the sets of all possible A. This is the space of gauge potential configurations. Okay? So since we are going to discuss the effect of gauge transformation, I'm going to denote what is a big gauge group I'm going to call G, which is the sets of all gauge transformation, where G denotes, as it is here, the group element that generates a gauge transformation. So it's a space. So this is the space of all local gauge transformations. Okay? And of course, G, so G is just a local gauge transformation. And this is a 2x2 unitary matrix. Okay, so in fact, each G of X, if you want to be very precise, is the data of G of X IG where is IG going from 1 to 2 with a constraint that GIG times G dagger GK is delta IK and determinant of G is equal to 1. Okay. And the effect of a gauge transformation is that I'm transforming gauge transformation, as we have seen, is that we have transforming A into G. A, and what was the definition? What was the exact definition? Yes. A G minus 1 plus I G, the ordinary derivative of G minus 1. That I'm going to call A transformed by the gauge transformation G. Okay? And if you work out the matrix element, the T's, this is d mu, etc. This is the standard notation, okay? It's just rewriting this, the formula which is there. Okay? Okay. So this big group G is just, if you want, it's just the direct product of SU2 for each element, each point in space-time. So you, I can rewrite this in a very, very formal way as direct products for all X belonging to space-time of SU2 of the gauge group G to the power X associated at point X. So I'm going to call the G SU2 is a gauge group. Okay? So it's just I have a collection of gauge group associated to each point of space-time. I just had the direct product. Okay? And I'm going to need to have to define what is a measure on this big gauge group. It's very formal. We're going to integrate over all the gauge transformation. So the measure of over G is going to be just the products of the measure on each little group. So I'm going to have defined a measure of a global, you know, local gauge transformation. And I'm going to define this just as a direct product of all the points in space-time of the measure on each element of G of X. Okay? And as a measure for this, I'm going to take the R measure on SU2. Measure of G is just the R measure on SU2, which is the invariant measure, the only property of a measure which is left. And in fact, in the case of SU2, and write invariant measure, which means that it's the same for each value of the points. If you take that the measure of some G naughts times G is the same as the measure of G, and it's the same than the measure of G times G naught for G naught fixed. So we are not going to need very precisely what the form of the R measure, but there is a unique measure on the group SU2 that has a property that it's the same everywhere for each point of the group. So it's invariant under the action of the group onto itself. Okay? And you, if you open any book of group theory, or if you, I don't know if you have seen that in the front end lecture in group theory, but so I can give you the explicit expression for the, oh, here it is, in fact, if you are going to be interested. An element of SU2 can always be written as cosine theta exponential I phi minus sine theta e minus I. Well, now there is 2 chi. Sine theta e I chi and cos theta e minus I phi. So you have three variables, theta, phi, and chi. So it's just three coordinates. And that's because, as we have seen, the SU2 group is the SU2 group for an element of SU2. The SU2 group is has dimension 3 as a real manifold. Okay? And then the R measure is just the measure d theta d phi d chi with a sine 2 theta. Okay. And you can check that this measure has this property. Well, it means that, you know, it's just the ordinary measure if you multiply by a phase, you know, in independent phase, this element and this element. And for the relative source, you have a sine 2 theta, which is a bit less natural. But in fact, should correspond to the representation of a SU2 group as a group of rotation of the sphere. And if you think about that, it's related to the representation of the fact that SU2 is more or less that SO3. So you can relate this. What?
Right?
Pardon? Yeah, it's the upper cover, but locally, it's the same group, and so the measure is a measure of local rotations. Okay. Okay, so that's standard group theory. Okay, so let's go back to this. So now I'm going to make a picture of what we have to do. So this is a local measure. The important point is that this is a local measure, which means that you sample independently the value of each component of the gauge potential at each point of space-time. And that, in fact, we need to take a measure like that because we want a theory that satisfies locality. And in the quantum theory. Locality in space-time. So that's needed to have causality, to have, etc. Okay. So that's basically the only measure that's going like that. Okay? And in fact, in addition, you can check that this measure is going to be invariant under gauge transformation. It's not completely obvious, but this measure is invariant under local gauge transformation. As it is defined like this, it's a bit formal, but basically it's because if you perform a gauge transformation, it's a linear, so you have just a global rotation by g and g minus 1. So this is sometimes a rotation which doesn't change this kind of measure. Plus, you add a linear term that is d mu of g minus 1, which is a translation. So gauge transformation means performing a rotation, a local rotation, and then a local translation in the flow for each point. So it's invariant. So this measure is invariant under the big group, which means that basically it has the same property than this one. Okay. So now, what's the problem? The problem is that, so we have defined the gauge transformation, we have defined a big group that is the group of all gauge transformations. That's a huge group, but we treat it as if it was well-defined. And now the question is that if we have a functional integral like that, basically, we have our space A. This curly A of all gauge transformation, of all configuration of all gauge potential, and we want to compute this integral. But, and here I have a picture, the big gauge group acts in this space. So A, so big G acts on the space of gauge configuration, which means that if you have you start from a given gauge configuration that I've denoted by A, gauge potential configuration, if you apply a gauge transformation, you get another gauge configuration, and considering all the gauge transformation, you obtain what's called an orbit. You get an orbit of G. Okay? And all the gauge configuration on a given orbit are gauge equivalent to this one. So they are physically equivalent. They are physically equivalent. And the action is the same. This is physically equivalent A. And S Young Mills is constant on each point. So this is a flat direction for S Young Mills. Okay. But now, of course, you have different orbits associated to physically inequivalent configurations. You see. And so the space of physically inequivalent configuration, we can write it formally. And what was my notation? Yes, here it is. So the space of physically inequivalent configurations, let me call it C for configurations, you can write it simply as a quotient of A by the action of G. So it's a quotient space. It's a space of orbits. Okay. And if we want to define a functional integral, well, you could integrate over A with this measure. Which is perfectly sensible. In fact, when using formalism of gauge fit on a lattice by Ken Wilson, and using computer simulation, Monte Carlo-like simulation, one can just integrate over the space of all configuration. One knows that one integrates over lots of completely equivalent configuration, but one is so sure that the result will be gauge invariant. Now, in perturbation theory, the problem is different, because in perturbation theory, really, you start from a special configuration. Let's say that it is here. Let's write it in red, which is, for instance, the classical vacuum state, which is A equals 0. That's it. So you have, let me write it like this. You have a classical, if you want, you have a classical vacuum, which is A equals 0. But which, of course, minimizes the action, the Young-Mills action. But it's equivalent to pure gauge configuration, which are of the forms, at least in d mu alpha. And since A mu is equal to 0, configuration of the form A equal d alpha are completely physically equivalent. So somewhere here, you have the orbits of pure gauge, which is the orbits of classical configuration that leads to vacuum configuration with E equal B equal 0. So F mu nu is equal to 0. Okay. And when we want to perform a path integral, we in perturbation theory, we are making a local perturbation, and the red direction is a zero mode. So what is a gauge transformation? gauge fixing procedure. The idea of gauge fixing procedure is very simple. So let me draw again this picture. Okay. What is gauge fixing? Gauge fixing consists in you start from this big configuration of all gauge potential configuration. You have your space of orbits. Of the action of the gauge group. And in each orbit, you choose a representative, or you devise a procedure where you hope to choose a representative. So this is a gauge fixing procedure. So for instance, let's hope that in each gauge orbit, there is only one gauge configuration that satisfies this condition. Then we pick it. Okay? Or let's assume that in each gauge, in each orbit, there is one configuration that satisfies the axial gauge, this one. Let's pick it. And so we define a subset of configuration that satisfies the gauge fixing condition. So that's what we are going to call a gauge slice. Okay? And we are going to replace this big integral by an integral over the gauge slice. Because since each configuration here and here are physically equivalent, we can just take one of them. Okay. And but of course, you can take another gauge fixing. And take another gauge slice. Okay. And if the for the calculation to make sense, we must find a way so that the results of the calculation integrating over this gauge fixing slice or this one gives the same result. Otherwise, the result will be inconsistent, and this immediately will have consequences because the results of when you compute correlation function, product matrix element of observable in the gauge theory, you will see violation of unitarity and a lot of very nasty things. So this has to, you have to find a way to gauge fix in a gauge invariant way. Okay, so I'm going again to write very compact notation. I'm going to write a gauge fixing procedure by stating that I define a gauge fixing functional or function that I'm going to write F. And the gauge fixing means that some sets of function F of A is equal to zero. So again, F of A is a notation which is very, very sketchy because F of A means simply, in fact, it's not just a single function, it's a data of a set of gauge fixing condition for each component of the field. Here, for instance, you have FA. Which depends on the value of the field. At given points, it may depend on the derivative of the fields, d nu a mu b of x. It may depend on higher derivative terms. You see? The gauge condition may depend on x itself. So you may choose a different gauge fixing condition at different points in space-time. And this for all x in Minkowski space-time, all a, because you get one gauge fixing condition for each gauge component of the vector. So for, okay, so you see, so F of A means a set of three gauge fixing conditions at each point of space involving the position in space, the value of the gauge potential and its derivative, and possibly its higher derivative. And FA equals zero means that each of these terms has to be equal to zero. So this is a big vector, and each of the components has to be equal to zero. So that's a very compact notation. Okay. And if you want to think about a bit about mathematically, so F of A is an application from the space of gauge potential configuration. So F is an application from the space of gauge potential configuration A mu into, you have one gauge fixing condition for space and for each A, so into the big, how can you call it that? Perhaps I can, the big, some kind of big Lie algebra, something from Germanic. Big Lie algebra is products over all points in space-time of little g of x, where little g of x is the Lie algebra of the group g at point x. Because you have one gauge fixing condition for each component in the Lie algebra. So this is a, if you want, this is a big, this is, if you want, this is a Lie algebra of the big gauge group. G. Okay. Well, in my lecture notes, I use some, I don't know, some fracture font that makes things clear. Okay. And so, these lines correspond to the given choice of F. Let's see. This is, means F equals zero. And this second slice corresponds to some f, new f, f prime, equals zero. Well, f prime is not the derivative, so let us write it f1 and f2. So you have different choice. Okay. So this gauge fixing procedure has this very simple geometrical interpretation, except that we have in a big and infinite dimensional configuration space. Okay, so gauge fixing condition means that we enforce a condition, a set of conditions on the gauge potential. Okay. And so we hope two things. First, we need that the gauge class have to be transverse to the gauge orbits. If they are tangent, it's not a good idea. We have not, okay. So we hope that, assume that, so first, of course, let's say, before doing the assumption, it's clear that we choose that if we take some f of a equals 0, if you change a into ag, where g is a small configuration, again, very compact notation for stating that it's an infinitesimal gauge transformation. We expect that f of ag is different from zero. This means that the gauge slice is transverse. So this gauge slice is transverse to the gauge orbits of A at point A. Okay, it means that this is this and this, and there is some angle if you want. Okay, so that's the first condition. But a second condition is that we hope that there is, if f of A equals 0, for any g gauge configuration in g, f of ag is different from 0. We expect that there is only one gauge fixed configuration in each orbit. In other words, we expect that this gauge slice, something that doesn't come back and things like that. We expect that we don't have something like that that occur, because then we would be counting, we'd be doing some overcounting. Okay. So this turns out, these conditions turns out to be highly non-trivial. In general, this is not true. Especially for the Landau gauge, which is the most used gauge because it's very convenient, it's not true. And this phenomenon is called the Gribov copies problem. Because you have copies of a given gauge configuration that I think. Okay. So in general, especially for the Landau-Lorentz gauge. Okay. And that's something that is particular to non-abelian gauge theory. It's related to the topology of configuration space and the fact that the SU2 group has a non-trivial topology, etc. Okay, so it's an interesting problem. It's not a completely solved problem. And last week there was an interesting seminar by visitors here about this problem and whether it can be used to have a better understanding of the confinement in gauge theories. But I'm not going to discuss that because basically we are going to do perturbation theory. So we are going to do perturbation theory. So we start from the point where A mu equal to 0, the classical vacuum. And we are going to explore the vicinity of this, the classical vacuum, And perturbation theory means considering what's the effect of the small fluctuation around the classical vacuum, classical solution. And one can show that in all those gauges, in fact, there are no Grieboff Coffee. If there are Grieboff Coffee, they are at a finite distance of the origin. So it's not a problem in perturbation theory. So we are going to ignore this problem because it's not a problem in perturbation theory. Okay. So what remains in perturbation theory to understand is how can we define, how can we gauge fix this in a consistent way, in particular, in a way where you keep locality in the integration of the field configuration, and independence into the choice of a gauge configuration. So the question is how to do this in a gauge fixing configuration. And basically, you cannot just take a naive measure on the slice, because for instance, you see that for a given slice here, if you want the measure of this and the measure of this is different, despite the fact that the measure here is invariant. So the measure here and the measure here is the same, because you can define what is the volume of an element in the space of gauge configuration, gauge potential configuration, yeah, this. And since this is invariant, remember, since we have that dAg basically is the same thing as the measure of dA, which is the measure is gauge invariant. So if you take a volume element in space of gauge configuration, transport it by the gauge configuration, you get an element with the same volume. But if you integrate naively on a gauge slice by taking the measure induced on the gauge slice, in general, the measure will be different. There will be some kind of Jacobian anyway. So you have to take this into account. And this is, so how to write this as a measure of all the A such that F of A is equal to 0. So which measure should we take if we want to integrate over all the gauge potential configurations that satisfies a given choice of gauge fixing. Okay, and it's here that the problem is different for U1 theory and for non-abelian gauge theories, and that's where it's become interesting. Okay, I have only little minutes, so let me just give an introduction. So how to perform this, define properly a measure on the space of on the gauge slice, in fact, has been the solution to this mathematical question has been devised by several people in the 60s, I think. First in the West by Feynman and Bryce DeWitt. Well, think all of you know Feynman and Bryce DeWitt. If you have not heard about him, he was one of the pioneers in the study of quantum gravity. And he made very important contribution to the study of gauge theories. Okay? And in the East, by Ludwig Fadeyev and Vladimir Popov in Russia. And remember, in those times, there were no internet, and there was something called the Iron Curtain that was quite severe. Okay, so, and the contribution of Fadeyev and Popov, since they introduced a trick called the ghost condition, it becomes, that's, those two names are mostly. Okay, so let me just give in the, let's, since we started with 5 minutes late, let me give just an example, a simple one-dimensional example. Okay. Let me assume that I have just this configuration space will be just one dimensional. Okay, so I replace A by a variable X, a real variable, which lives on a line. And for some reason, there is some symmetry like this one, and I want to pick one representative. So, x naught. And this x naught will be defined not by the choice of x naught. I don't know what x naught, but I want to choose an x naught that satisfies the gauge fixing condition. So I assume that I have a function, some function f, such that f of x naught is equal to 0. So I have my function f here. Let me write my function f. Okay, this is f of x. Okay? And this is the analog of my gauge fixing condition. Gauge fixing. Okay? And I want to pick the point where x naught, where f of x naught is equal to 0. Okay? So picking a point means using a delta function. So I want to do something very, very stupid. I want to just pick one by writing that integral over dx of delta of x minus x naught. And this is, of course, equal to 1. So this gives the correct weight 1. Okay? But imagine that f is a very complicated function, and I don't know what this function f is. Yeah, it's difficult to find x naught. So of course, you better want to write it as integral dx, a delta function of f of x. But of course, if you do this, this is not one, because you have made a change of variable. So you have to add this by the absolute value of the derivative of f at point x naught. So this is the derivative here. Okay? Derivative of f. And you have to take the absolute value because if the function was at a negative slope, you still want to pick it with a weight 1, the point x naught. Okay. So this is a realization of a gauge fixing condition. And this is a the Jacobian of the change of variables from x to f of x. You want. Okay? So you see on this very simple example that picking a point here by a gauge fixing condition induce, you have to take into account some modification, some normalization. Yes?
What do you mean when you say that the wave is 1?
Pardon?
What did you mean when you said that the wave was 1?
No, I just want that this points counts by a factor 1, so that when I am computing, you know, if I want now to compute what is some function g of x naught, g is another function. I write it as dx g of x delta of x minus x naught. And this is going to be, if I want to rewrite this, I write this as dx delta of f of x g of x. But then I still have this f prime of x. Okay, that's what I mean. Okay, and well, this is in one dimension, but now if you have in n dimension, so if you have a point x which is x1 up to xn, you're integrating in Rn, and if you have n condition, so you have a function f, which is a function f1 fn, where each fi, fa is a function of x1 xn. So this is a vector. This is a vector function. And you assume that you have a given x1 such that f of x is equal to 0, which means that f1 equal f2 equal fn equals 0. So you have n gauge fixing condition, one for each component. And you want to write the same kind of integral. You want to write that integral dx, well, now d capital X delta of x minus x naught is equal to 1. So this is an integral in n dimension, and that's a delta function in n dimensional space. So it's a delta function, you know, the mass function at the point x naught. You can write this as integral dx in n dimension delta n of f of x. And again, this is delta, so it's a delta function. It's a delta constraint on each component of the vector f. So it means that delta of f1, delta of n2, delta of f3, this is delta of f1, delta of f2, delta of fn. And then you have the generalization in n dimension of this, which is obviously the absolute value of the determinant of the Jacobian matrix df over dx, where this is a Jacobian matrix of the change of variables. So this is a matrix d over dx ab is a partial derivative of the fa with respect to xb. So you see the absolute value of a determinant. Okay. So this is something very simple, but basically if you understand what this corresponds to in a finite number of dimension, we are going to use this formula to perform a correct gauge fixing condition for the path integral of a gauge field configuration. So the integration over x will be replaced by integration of a gauge field configuration. The function f will be replaced by the gauge fixing condition. And this matrix will be replaced by a differential operator, which is called Fadiev Popov gauge fixing operator. Okay, but we'll see that tomorrow. Thank you.